Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. I really don't know what I can say that hasn't been said over and over again like a drumbeat. Trump, 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 trumping to a monotonous, irritating Trump beat. How do we speak or think of Trump? Is there a Shakespeare in the house, an Edgar Allan Poe, or a Mickey Spillane, perhaps? The national media in all its hydraic forms represents what Trump viciously denigrates as an enemy of the state and as fake news, and offers, as an alternative, his own alternative facts. Aka lies, falsehoods, fibs, untruths, humbug, Trump bug, trumped up stories, a crock of Trump. The disgraced Spiro Agnew voiced a more vigorous denunciation of the bloodhounds of the Fourth Estate, lampooning them as nattering nabobs of negativity, which many media members happily validated. But Gene Fowler said it best nearly a century ago when he called journalism history shot on the wing, quote unquote. The gathering and dissemination of factual truth without fear, favor, prejudice, or deceit. Unfortunately, our beleaguered democracy is being unstatutorily raped by banal avarice and equally vile prejudices that bitterly resent cosmopolitan integration and universality. The ugly rise of Trump might show the rest of the world how patently evil such irrational misanthropy, combined with recklessly impulsive and narcissistic megalomania, is to humanity's future, and the volatile threat of annihilation of the entire species of these nouveau neo-millennial reactionary racists and autocratic fascists don't get their monstrous new model final solution. Which poses a critical and even possibly fatal weakness in the American electoral system. How did Trump out-Trump democracy? The next president, if there is one, should, as the first presidential act, decontaminate the White House. And if that is not enough to dispel the odious legacy of Trump, then it ought to be burned to the last ember and the ground declared forever cursed. Well, that's my rant for this week. And now we will go on to my old friend, David Horowitz. And he, more or less, is offering a Jim Comey brief on Timothy Snyder's historical lessons on tyranny for the age of Trump. Yale University historian Timothy Snyder, author of On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century, and recently published The Road to Unfreedom, Russia, Europe, America, delivered the 11th annual Sarah Glasgow Cogan Memorial Lecture at Portland State University on April 25th in an event sponsored by the university's program in Judaic Studies and the Oregon Jewish Museum. What follows is a summary of Professor Snyder's remarks, reconstructed in Jim Comey fashion, like the memos, to the best of my memory after the fact. Readers should be advised that the speaker should not be held responsible for any misstatements of facts, omissions, or representations that may be contained in this effort. Should you find this summation helpful, feel free to distribute it in any form to whomever you please. And now, the summation by David A. Horowitz. Europe's experiences with 20th century tyranny, particularly those associated with the rise of the Third Reich, suggest that the first imperative of resistance is not to render obedience in advance. This means not normalizing or accommodating to developments that offend basic values or sensibilities under the assumption that they are not significant and will pass. One must never lose the sense of individual agency and the ability to speak out in defense of humane values while appreciating the importance of structure. The Nazi state of the 1930s built its power by eroding rule of law, the institutions that govern civility, toleration for others, and the civic state. Using the Reichstag fire as a pretext, Hitler called for the temporary, and that's a quote, abolition of the German constitution and parliamentary democracy in an alleged emergency, gradually inducing one man and one party rule. He came to power with an ideology resting on the premise that history involved the effort of powerful groups to dominate over lesser peoples by conquering their territory and expropriating their food and other resources. In that sense, methods of organizing societies through concepts of democratic governance, capitalism, communism, or even the application of science were irrelevant to the basic struggle for dominance. Curiously, Hitler tied the attributes of civil society to the Jews, whose alleged application of universal values to the social arena constituted a contradiction of the ethos that might makes right. Realizing that emotions were a far more profound tool of bonding than the use of reason or adherence to fact, Hitler invoked the big lie to suggest that a global conspiracy of Jewish interests was threatening the purity of the German people and the new order. This myth gradually penetrated German society. One Jewish family noted in their diary that things appeared irreversible on the day their neighbors failed to make eye contact when passing on the street. Days later, they noticed that neighbors literally crossed the street to avoid confronting them. The logical culmination of Nazi ideology was that the Jews had to be obliterated to erase their seemingly decadent notions of human sociability from German consciousness. Yet Nazi death camps were confined to the territories the Wehrmacht conquered in Eastern Europe, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, the Soviet Union, and Poland, not Germany itself. Significantly, these were areas where German troops destroyed institutions and infrastructure by expropriating resources and leaving remaining food supplies to those who could forcefully command them, leaving the mainly landless Jews as the most besieged minority. Nazi appeals to raw emotion, a cult of leadership, national pride, racial exclusivity, and envy of cosmopolitan elites were among the predicates of authoritarian rule. But perhaps the most applicable trait to our own circumstances was the notion that if all truth was to be shared exclusively between the leader and his constituents, some people, or the real people, independent empirical fact and reality had to be discounted or at least obscured in ambiguity. Donald Trump, with the help of the Russian operatives who attacked the central mechanism of American democracy in the election of 2016, has proven a master of these techniques. As a failed business entrepreneur rescued by Russian money laundering through real estate investments, Trump made a career of playing a successful businessman on television while the Russians groomed him for a potential run for the presidency. His understanding of the utility of the big lie, as in Obama's birthplace and religion, immigrant crime, voter fraud, and later Hillary Clinton's imagined criminality, perfectly served his followers. Although Trump never lied in the technical sense, since he had no ability or need to distinguish the fragments in his head from objective reality, his repetition of internet memes and Russian disinformation served to cloud the waters sufficiently so that no statement of empirical reality could escape contradiction. Like the architects of the Third Reich, Trump and the Russians understood the pull of emotion on vulnerable constituencies. Cleverly targeting key electoral college states, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, where small numbers of voters with economic grievances could swing the election, Russian operatives planted misleading rumors and pseudo ads in social media to cast doubt on the democratic process and the democratic candidate. Perhaps as a test of future capacity, the Russians even created a false website for the Tennessee Republican Party, whose followers and donations far outstripped those of the legitimate Republican site. In a more recent example, Russian operatives used social media to spread the rumor that the outspoken Parkland, Florida high school survivors of a mass shooting were crisis actors, quote unquote. The point of these campaigns is not to sway minds, but to sow doubt and confusion and a lack of faith in a, quote, rigged system. The internet contributes to this process by categorizing users into segmented bodies fed the information satisfying their pre-existing predispositions. User history, for example, figures into the priority of choices Google offers patrons employing its search engine. Beyond that, the internet and social media mainly are geared to emotional needs for confirmation of individual biases and group identity, not the objective search for information, its proponents once heralded. One of the most important ways of resisting the slide toward autocracy is to maintain a healthy respect for empirical reality and independent science. No subject illustrates this more than acceptance of climate change. At this point, the United States is the only nation in the world whose government remains a climate denier. Yet, as a self-identified leader of global anti-terrorism, you would think it would be concerned about the disruptive instability and migratory patterns emerging in the swath of mainly Muslim territory, from North Africa to Indonesia, experiencing the effects of the droughts and monsoons climate change is generating. From the perspective of history, it's instructive to note that Adolf Hitler's ideological fixation on the struggle for dominance led him to disparage science as irrelevant, as in his rejection of modern agricultural applications, such as the use of fertilizers or hybrid crossbreeding. Looking at the features of autocracy in the Third Reich does not mean that history necessarily repeats itself and that phenomena take the same form as in the past. But studying history does allow us to see patterns with the possibility that we can learn from them if we have the courage to do so, and if we are able to separate our minds from the self-confirming sentiments that cushion us from choices that must be confronted. That is the good news. And that was by David Horowitz, a Jim Comey brief on Timothy Snyder's historical lesson on tyranny for the age of Trump, as interpreted by David A. Horowitz, who has taught history at Portland State University for 50 years, since the turbulent year of 1968. He is now professor emeritus, and among his many books, articles, papers, etc., he has also included an autobiography his students urged him to write, Getting There, An American Cultural Odyssey, written in 2015. And now, along somewhat the same subject, Can It Happen Here? Review of that book, Urgent Studies in Rise of Authoritarian America by Charles Kaiser. And he wrote this for The Guardian. The 17 thinkers who have contributed to this new collection of essays come down firmly on all sides of its central question. Is the United States destined to become an authoritarian state? Multiple points of view are expressed by the book's editor, Cass Sunstein, alone. In his introduction, Sunstein writes, "My own summary of this book, absolutely. It has happened before. It will happen again. To many Americans, something like it is happening now." And yet, 56 pages later, speaking only for himself, he says the opposite. In my view, it really can't. In another collection, such a contradiction might be a problem. Here, it isn't. The medley of viewpoints expressed suggests something much closer to intellectual honesty than scholarly sloppiness. The truth is, no one can be certain. But whether you are an optimist, a pessimist, or an idealist without illusions, John F. Kennedy's self-reverential description, this book bombards you with all the reasons that anyone who treasures democracy needs to be terrified by the current state of our republic. It is, of course, the presence of Donald Trump in the White House that gives so many a sense of emergency. But like many recent books, this one argues that the Trump catastrophe is really just the culmination of 50 years of constitutional decay rather than some sudden, unpredictable event. The Yale Law professor Jack Balkin calls Trump a demagogue out of central casting, quote, unruly, uncouth, mendacious, dishonest, and cunning, unquote. His presidency is, quote, a symptom of constitutional rot and dysfunction. Balkin argues that the rise of American oligarchy is central to the steady decline of democracy. He attributes the growth of oligarchy to changes in how political campaigns are financed, allowing gigantic amounts of dark money, basic changes in the structure of mass media, which have encouraged political distrust, and the merger of politics with entertainment. The central goal of the Republican agenda, Balkin writes, is to deliver benefits to the donor class. Republicans have no scruples about acting in an entirely shameless manner as long as the interests of its masters are well served. Trump's populism is just a shameless Potemkin village. Whether or not fascism is coming to America, it is undeniable that the internet has put more in place to make it possible than there has ever been before. Its infrastructure has enabled an almost complete and barely protested disappearance of privacy and the near disappearance of the very concept of truth. In a particularly well-focused essay about how Russia is contributing to the rise of fascism, the former ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, Sunstein's wife, says the current media environment gives propaganda and falsehoods unprecedented power. Samantha Power provides extremely useful history on Russian efforts to interfere with U.S. elections, which go back to at least 1984, when the KGB secretly campaigned against Ronald Reagan's re-election. Just as they did during the 2016 election, the Russians spread all kinds of false stories, including the idea the CIA was plotting to give nuclear weapons to apartheid South Africa. Then Samantha Power pinpoints why the Russians were so much less effective back then. During the Cold War, the vast majority of Americans received their news via mediated platforms. This meant that what they read or saw on television, quote, had to get by professional gatekeepers, unquote. As far as the dissemination of news is concerned, that is the crucial difference between the pre- and post-internet worlds. The gatekeepers have disappeared. Add to that the fact that bots accounted for 3.8 million tweets in the final weeks of the 2016 election, and that 38 million false stories were shared on Facebook in the last 3 months of the campaign, and you get some idea of the damage the internet has inflicted on American democracy. Fox News routinely amplified falsehoods, quote unquote, that discredited Hillary Clinton. All in all, it's no surprise, as Samantha Power points out, that large numbers of Americans now view as opinion what were once seen as verifiable facts, everything from global warming to the utility of vaccinating children. Several contributors focus on the potentially catastrophic reaction Trump could orchestrate in the wake of a large-scale terrorist attack. The Yale Law professor Bruce Ackerman argues that the prospect of a draconian response, quote-unquote, by Trump, quote, should jolt serious Democrats and Republicans, unquote, into passing a new statutory framework that would explicitly reject the claim made by Jay Bybee and John Yoo for the Bush administration, quote, that the commander-in-chief has a unilateral power to make an never-ending war on the home front, unquote. Unfortunately, with spineless Republicans controlling both houses of Congress, there is zero chance of such an initiative now. In the category of it has happened here already, the Harvard Law School Dean Martha Minow recalls the internment of 120,000 Japanese, including 70,000 American citizens, during the Second World War. Despite intense contemporaneous dissents, it's a quote, and scholarly criticism, also a quote, the Supreme Court has never overturned the decision that made that horrendous episode possible. A Trump spokesperson even cited it as a worthy precedent for his proposed registry of immigrants from Muslim countries. The Chicago University law professor David Strauss highlights another instance when it did happen in the U.S. Quote, for roughly 80 years, beginning at the end of the 19th century, parts of the United States were ruled by an undemocratic, illiberal, racist regime, and African Americans were denied the right to vote and were violently repressed with the tacit approval of the government, quote unquote. Right now, there are really only two things that can restore our faith in the rule of law and beat back lethal tendencies toward fascism. The first is a successful conclusion of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into the alleged misdeeds of Trump and his dubious minions. The other is a new wave of energy from the progressive majority in the November elections, which could replace Trump's Republican supplicants with Democrats who would actually impose serious limits on this White House. as the New York University law professor Stephen Holmes puts it towards the end of the book, even if our system doesn't guarantee good governance, a change in the team in power can still produce a sense of buoyant expectancy and social energy throughout the community. And those are quotes from Holmes. The main reason for optimism about such new energy did not exist when this book was printed. The teenaged Americans now fighting to bring sanity to the nation's gun laws. These magnificent young people must become the vanguard of a mass movement to rescue America from the Republican donor class and to return it finally to its senses. And that was Can It Happen Here? By Charles Kaiser. He's reviewing the book, more or less, and he's the author of 1968 in America, republished in April, a 30th anniversary edition, and The Gay Metropolis and the Cost of Courage. And now, by Dr. Robert Brake. We're number one, or are we? Saturday, February 17th, 2018, marked the 77th anniversary of the publication of a seminal essay, one that later led to the enduring notion of American exceptionalism. Henry Booth Luce, founder of Time and Life magazines, composed the American Century, quote unquote, which reckoned with the shock of economic devastation at home and with military peril poised from abroad. Luce formulated a definition of national purpose, exemplifying a wider struggle to celebrate America's virtues and reclaiming its past. The 1941 essay was a milestone in the effort to distill the meaning of Americanism, singling out almost every professed ideal: freedom, democracy, equality of opportunity, self-reliance, independence, cooperation, justice, and charity. Luce was the son of a Presbyterian family whose life was devoted to spreading the word to the heathen. And that heathen was in China, where Luce was raised. His parents were missionaries. Luce wasn't the first American to proclaim our exceptionalism. In 1630, John Winthrop, the first governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, declared that we shall be as a city upon a hill. The eyes of all people are on us. That sentiment, uttered long before there was an American country, was later echoed by Ronald Reagan and others. America was chosen by Providence to redeem mankind, or so it seemed. And during his travels across the country in 1831 and 1832, the French statesman Alexis de Tocqueville concluded that the position of America is therefore quite exceptional. During President Barack Obama's tenure, Republican leaders like Newt Gingrich, Mitt Romney, and Rudolph Giuliani claimed that Obama didn't really love America and didn't appreciate what an exceptional country we are. Obama responded, celebrating diversity and service to his country as one of the reasons that America is exceptional. He said, "I believe in American exceptionalism, just as I suspect that the Brits believe in British exceptionalism and the Greeks believe in Greek exceptionalism." Then came Trump, who has disavowed the very idea of American exceptionalism, replacing it, at least temporarily, with the "America First" angrier tagline, freighted with dark meaning. Trump's election and the conditions surrounding it, a growing rejection of science and facts, extreme political tribalism, a popular reaction to immigration and free trade, and Trump's assertion that we're getting our butts kicked by other countries, seem to offer conclusive proof that there is nothing at all exceptional about the United States. While Trump still argues that we're losing big time, his remarks seem a rather comical or oversimplification of what American exceptionalism debate is all about. Nevertheless, the Donald vows to make America a winner again. He probably doesn't object to the idea that we should be superior to all other countries or to the idea that we should ideally be able to see ourselves that way. He just thinks we aren't cutting it. Returning to Henry Luce's seminal American Century essay of 1941, I'm wondering how his message would be interpreted today. It remains idealistic, patronizing, moralistic, paternalistic, riddled with double standards and hypocrisy, and notably lacking in self-reflection and self-criticism. In that regard, the Henry Luce of 1941 would have found the righteous certainty and missionary rhetoric of his country, 77 years later, familiar and probably comforting. No one who died in 1967, as did Luce, could have imagined how America would emerge from the Vietnam War, which he fervently supported, so tarnished and humiliated, or how the digital revolution would transform the world, or how the clashes between nations would be followed by an epic of violence and terror that succeeded in making fear itself a bedrock feature of America and the American century. It is not difficult to imagine Luce being astonished and confounded by the chaos of the 21st century, which differed so greatly from the titanic collision of nations and ideologies that prompted him to write his hopeful vision in 1941. Of course, Luce's American century catchphrase was hyperbole, papering over glaring inequalities of race, class, gender, and privilege within the United States. Yet, not unreasonably, Luce's catchphrase persists. The 21st century world may be chaotic with violence erupting from sources and causes, but the United States does remain the planet's sole superpower. So the myth of exceptionalism still holds most Americans in its thrall. Just consider for a moment all those American patriots who feverishly chant, "We're number one, we're number one." And that was by Robert Brake. And he is a retired teacher living in Ocean Park, Washington. He contributes columns to the Chinook Observer and to this radio program. And this article was, "We're Number One, or Are We?" And I was born in 1941, and so was David Horowitz 2 days before I was. Just as a little note, this is Michael McCusker. Today is the 64th anniversary of the unanimous 1954 Supreme Court decision that ended legal school segregation in the United States, Brown versus the Topeka, Kansas Board of Education. 56 years earlier, the Supreme Court on this very same date in 1898 ruled 7-1 in favor of Plessy versus Ferguson, which set the standard of separate but equal accommodations for the white and colored races, quote unquote, until 1954, when a later Supreme Court struck down that ruling with Brown versus the Board of Education. And Linda Brown, the principal name on that case, died this past March 25th. She was 77 years old, and she spent her life as a civil rights activist. She was also born in 1941.